The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
As I was saying, those people who are right now, there's a written version of my presentation. I'm not going to read it, but you can read it afterward. So let me start by thanking the organizers of the conference for inviting me and for making it possible for me to be here. I'm very happy to be here. So I cannot thank them that much about the title that they gave to my lecture, which is Puerto Rico in the American Century. That would imply that I would have to speak about the whole 20th century and 20 years more in 40 minutes, which would take too long. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk very broadly about some aspects of Puerto Rico's history in the 20th century, very broadly. And then I'm going to speak about some of the causes or the roots of the present crisis. And then I'm going to end with some aspects of what our response should be to that crisis. So very broadly speaking, I guess the first fact that we should remember about Puerto Rico is that it has been a colony of the United States since the War of 1898, the Spanish-American War. In 1901, to give you the official definition or the judicial definition, in 1901 the U.S. Supreme Court, in a series of decisions known as the Insular Cases, defined Puerto Rico as an unincorporated territory of the United States. Before that you had territories and states. Now they came up with a new category, which is unincorporated territories. And they defined unincorporated territories as territories that are possessions of the United States, but not part of the United States. And being possessions and not part, they are under the plenary powers of Congress, which means that Congress has complete powers to decide what to do with these territories and the people in the territory. And using that power, the Congress has reorganized the government of Puerto Rico over the years. The present organization, in Spanish, the official name is Estado Libre Asociado. In English, the official name is Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. You may hear that name when you read about Puerto Rico in the press. It's a government in which the people in Puerto Rico elect the governor, the legislature, the mayors of the municipalities, and so on. But all of these governments only deal with internal matters, matters internal to Puerto Rico. All the federal legislation applies to Puerto Rico. All the decisions of the President of the United States apply to Puerto Rico. Decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court apply to Puerto Rico, and so on, even though we don't have any participation in, not even in the formal election of any of these entities. So it's, as I said, a colony, officially an unincorporated territory. Now, colonialism also has an economic dimension, a material, more material dimension. And I want to focus on that. I'm going to put my emphasis on that aspect. I'm not going to speak about the cultural aspects of colonialism or the other political aspects of colonialism because I don't have time. If you have questions about that, we can go into it afterward. So if you look at Puerto Rico through the 20th century, you will see that there are some elements that have remained constant, even through all the changes that we have gone through. And I'm going to mention six elements that have remained constant all through the period after 1898. Fact number one is the fact that the economy of Puerto Rico is controlled by U.S. corporations. It has been so. That control has existed ever since the early 20th century, when Puerto Rico was fundamentally a sugar-producing country, a sugar economy. It was the case after the Second World War, in the period in which we had light manufacturing as the most important economic activity in Puerto Rico, and it remains so today when we have what they call capital-intensive investments in Puerto Rico. Pharmaceuticals are the most important ones. All through the 20th century and up to now, the economy of Puerto Rico is basically owned by big U.S. corporations. All the fundamental productive sectors are under the control of U.S. capital. Under that control, that's aspect number two, the economy of Puerto Rico has had three characteristics. One of them is that it has been one-sided. It specializes. It has specialized in one or two things in any particular moment. First it was sugar, then it was light manufacturing, now it's pharmaceuticals and a few other high-tech products. Second, it has been very vulnerable for that very same reason. If anything happens in that sector in which it is specialized, then the whole economy it's in trouble. You know, if there's a crisis in sugar, then the whole Puerto Rican economy is in crisis because it only produces sugar, doesn't produce anything else. In the same fashion, it has been, it has had a very discontinuous development. That is, you specialize in sugar, then that's the end of sugar, and then you have light manufacturing, and then the end of that, and then you have high-tech production. So there's no continuity from one period to the next. If you travel through the island, you will see all sorts of economic ruins. You will see the old sugar mills that are, you know, the structures are still there, or the old factories that are there. And I guess in the future, you will see the old pharmaceutical companies that were there once. And the other element, the third element is what we could call surplus extraction, which is that over the whole century and this century, much of the wealth, much of the income that is produced in Puerto Rico leaves the island. It goes somewhere else. It goes basically to the United States in the forms of profits of corporations operating in Puerto Rico. To give you an example, economists calculate that today $35 billion leave the island every year in the form of profits or dividends of the corporations operating in Puerto Rico. $35 billion is about 35% of Puerto Rico's gross domestic product, so it's a huge amount. I should make the nuancing that those $35 billion that leave the island every year include income that is actually generated in Puerto Rico, and also income that is declared in Puerto Rico by this corporation in order to avoid paying taxes somewhere else. But it's still a very significant amount of money that leaves the island every year. The fourth aspect, is the fact that all of this wealth that is not reinvested in Puerto Rico evidently does not create employment in Puerto Rico. And one of the other aspects of the fourth aspect of Puerto Rico's reality ever since 1898 has been mass unemployment. That is, this colonial, externally controlled economy has never been able to generate enough employment for the people in Puerto Rico that are able to work. Right now, the labor participation rate in Puerto Rico, you know, labor participation rate is the percentage of people who are older than 16 years old that are either working or looking for employment. The labor participation rate in Puerto Rico right now is about 39-40%. The figure in the United States is about 65%. So these are people who are not even looking for work because they've given up trying to find work. And the unemployment rate is about 10-11%, so it's more than double what is in the United States. The normal situation in Puerto Rico regarding unemployment is what you in the United States would consider a major depression. This is the normal situation that exists in Puerto Rico. Given that lack of employment that has been chronic, as I said, not seasonal but chronic, it's no surprise that migration has been a very important aspect of Puerto Rican life ever since the early 20th century. People leave the island in order to find employment. This was the case in the early 20th century when the first Puerto Rican communities took shape in New York. It was the case in the 1950s where there was mass migration in the 1950s. And it's the case today in the last 10 years of economic contraction that we have gone through. Just to give you an example, in the 1950s and early 60s, when Puerto Rico went through its period of most rapid economic growth, the most prosperous moment we've had in the last century, the actual number of jobs in Puerto Rico fell, the absolute numbers of jobs fell. If the unemployment rate didn't go up sharply in that period, it was because so many people were leaving the island. So jobs fell, unemployment fell because so many hundreds of thousands of people were leaving in the 1950s. The mass unemployment, needless to say, works against rising wages. One of the factors that helps explain the sixth element that I wanted to mention, which is the persistence of considerable and mass poverty in Puerto Rico. In Puerto Rico, about 45% of the people, this is before the storm, after Maria, probably this has surely gone up. Before the storm, about 45% of the people in Puerto Rico lived under the official poverty level. I guess I think in the United States it's like 15% of the population. 55% of the children lived under the poverty level in Puerto Rico. As I said, before the storm, I'm sure this has gone up afterward. So, and not only mass poverty in Puerto Rico, but also the persistence of the gap between the living standards in Puerto Rico and the United States. That is to say, after 120 years of US rule over Puerto Rico, the per capita income in Puerto Rico is about one-third of the United States. It is about one-half of the per capita income of the poorest state, which is Mississippi. So the not only is it poor, but the differential with the United States remains very significant. I'm going to come back to that at the end because I think we have to draw some conclusions from that. So given that level of poverty, it's not surprising, we could add like a seventh element into that description, that many people, and I mention this because it comes out in the news a lot, it's not surprising that many people in Puerto Rico qualify for some one or of many federally funded welfare programs in Puerto Rico. And here we have to get our cause and effect, our causality straight. It is not welfare that creates unemployment, as the neoliberal ideologies would tell you, you know, in order to justify welfare cuts. It's the other way around. It's the fact that there's no employment that leads people, puts people in the hands of these welfare apparatus, which are in many ways inadequate. So, to go to the second aspect of what I'm hoping to cover today, the present crisis. What I have given you is like a, some basic elements of Puerto Rican society ever since 1898. The present crisis, in order to understand it, we should go a little bit back in history. You know, all of you know that after the Second World War, the world capitalist economy and the US economy went through a period of very rapid expansion and very rapid growth, the post-war boom. And Puerto Rico participated in that without shedding its colonial nature, but it underwent a certain economic growth and expansion. And that the way that Puerto Rico participated in that post-war expansion was determined, was shaped by several elements. I'm going to mention three of them. They are not the only ones, but three of them. One of them is the policy of tax exemption. In 1947, the government of Puerto Rico adopted a policy which remains in place till today, which was known as the policy of tax exemption. What it means is what the title says. It will not collect taxes from U.S. corporations operating in Puerto Rico. The theory was, you know, we attract them by offering them a tax exception, a tax holiday. Now, this was very attractive to U.S. corporations because at the time, they didn't have to pay federal taxes while they were operating in Puerto Rico either. So by operating in Puerto Rico, these light manufacturing companies wouldn't have to pay taxes to the Puerto Rican government or to the federal government. So they basically paid no taxes. And that made Puerto Rico a rather attractive place to invest. And the second element that was significant in shaping Puerto Rico's growth at that time is that Puerto Rico at that time had what was at that moment was sort of privileged or exceptional access to the US market. That is to say, many other countries still had to pay tariffs, some sort of tariff to bring their products into the United States, while Puerto Rico had open access or unrestricted access. So that also made it attractive to possible investors in Puerto Rico to put their money and invest in the island. And the third element was that Puerto Rico, as it was advertised at the time openly, offered the lowest wages under the US flag. This was kind of the slogan that they used. You know, come here, we have the lowest wages under the US flag, you have access to the US market, and you don't have to pay any taxes. So this was the formula for attracting US corporations to Puerto Rico after 1945. And to a certain extent, it worked. It worked to a certain extent. As I said, it was never able to reduce or eliminate mass unemployment, but there were factories established, there were jobs created, there were higher paying jobs than they used to be in the sugarcane industry, and so on. So Puerto Rico did undergo some form of economic growth in the post-war period. Now, to make a long history short, all of these elements that I have mentioned have eroded over time. They have been disappearing over time. With the coming of neoliberal free trade policies and so on, the elimination of tariff barriers, Puerto Rico's privileged access to the U.S. market ceased to be privileged. That is, other people gain access to the U.S. market in the same terms that Puerto Rico had before. A primary example of that, a significant example of that, is Mexico. After NAFTA, Mexico also had equal access to the U.S. markets as Puerto Rico does. So that special attractiveness that Puerto Rico could have was there no more. The second element is that the Congress, as of 1996, began to eliminate the federal tax exemption policies that had existed for a long time. Now, I want to be clear about this because it's many people in Puerto Rico say, well, this was terrible that Congress eliminated that. We should get that back because that was the basis of our economic system before the Congress eliminated that. That was never enough. I mean, we should not have any nostalgia for that. We should not ask for them to bring this back. But the fact is that Congress eliminated that mechanism without putting anything in its place. You know, there was nothing to put in its place. As I have a rather ugly image, which I use sometimes to explain this. If somebody, you know, somebody cannot walk very well and they have a broken how you call it? Muleta, a crutch? You have a broken crutch, and and they take away the crutch. You know, that's, you know, it's not the broken crutch is not the solution, but you are worse off now than you were with the broken crutch. So that's why, you know, that's the situation in Puerto Rico. We had a broken crutch, now we have nothing, and so the situation got worse, and the same policies that brought us, you know, free trade and unrestricted trade and more intense competition in the world market also brought us financial deregulation, which among other things brought us the crisis of 2008, which hit Puerto Rico very strongly as many other places. So under the impact of these three things, you know, the Puerto Rican economy first stopped growing, then it stagnated, and then it began shrinking. It hasn't grown ever since 2006. The economy of Puerto Rico hasn't grown. To give you some figures that are significant for us, in the last decade, about 250,000 jobs have been eliminated in Puerto Rico. That's about 20%, or close to 25%, of the jobs that existed in Puerto Rico a decade ago, a little bit more than a decade ago, disappeared. You know, one fifth of the jobs are gone. In matter of one decade. It is a very strong impact on any society and any economy. The manufacturing jobs, which were the best paying jobs in Puerto Rico, more than halved over this 10-year period. There were about, or 20-year period, there were about 180,000 manufacturing jobs in Puerto Rico in 1996, more or less. And now there's less than 70,000. So more than half of the manufacturing jobs, more half of the best paying jobs have disappeared over this period. It's, as I said, it's no wonder that so many people have left the island over these many years, because you know, they are jobless and they cannot find a job in Puerto Rico, and they don't have any hope of finding a job in Puerto Rico. There's a decreasing number of jobs, you know, year after year. There are other facts, you know, that are in the written presentation that I gave you. I'm not going to burden you with them now. So as the economy of Puerto Rico stopped growing by 2006, the government revenue fell as well, as you may expect. And the government of Puerto Rico had basically three options to respond to this grave situation. One of them was to reevaluate, to reconsider the tax exemption policies that I mentioned before, policies that were not generating economic growth and were evidently allowing billions of dollars to leave the island that didn't contribute to the economic development of the island. They could reconsider that as one option. The other option was to begin to apply austerity measures, government budget cutbacks against, would affect mainly working people in Puerto Rico. And the third option was to borrow more money, needless to say, in order to avoid doing the other two. Well, the fact is that they did, the three of them, but not with equal emphasis. They did reconsider, in a very limited way, the tax exemption policies. They imposed a 4% excise tax on some transactions of the multinational corporations in Puerto Rico. It was a minimum tax. But to, just to give you an idea, that minimum tax on the multinational corporations today amounts to about 20% or one-fifth of the income of the government of Puerto Rico. It gives you, an idea of the size of these businesses, that only 4%, a small percent tax on them, can cover, you know, one-fifth of the revenue of the government of Puerto Rico. But this is not their emphasis. Their emphasis was in the other two. There were austerity measures began to be applied as early as 2006. In 2006, there's a little list there in the written presentation. You can check it out later. In 2006, for example, there was a consumer tax imposed on basically Puerto Rico's working people. You know, consumer taxes are regressive. They affect the poorest the hardest. And we call it the IBU, and this was imposed in 2006. In 2009, we had a public mass public employee firings. About 17,000 public employees were fired, outright fired from government employment. It was a very traumatic moment in Puerto Rico. In 2014, we had a law, it's called Law 66, which was a major attack on gains of public sector workers, you know, wages and benefits and contracts which were frozen and so on and so forth. Major attack on public sector workers. And in all through these years, we've had this policy of reducing government employment, basically not only firings in 2009, but through attrition. When people resigned or retire and so on, their places of work are plazas, or I don't know how you call them in English. Their posts are frozen or eliminated. You know, where I work is a good example. You know, I work in a research center at the University of Puerto Rico, and secretary retires, then there's no secretary. If a librarian retires, then, you know, nobody replaces them. So it's an increasingly lesser number of people doing the same work in where I work. Happens all over government agencies in Puerto Rico, has been happening for more than a decade. And in 2015, the sales tax that I mentioned before was increased, more than doubled. So all of these measures were imposed from 2006 on. Now, what the government did do with great emphasis after 2006 was to borrow more money. Between 2006 and 2014, which was the last time they were able to borrow significant amounts of money, the public debt grew by 64%. It went from 43 billion to 73 billion. So it grew in 30 billion over a matter of 8 years. And these bonds that the Puerto Rico government put out, this debt that the Puerto Rico government incurred, was very attractive to investors outside of Puerto Rico, particularly investors in the US, for the reason that the dividends from these bonds of Puerto Rico's government are also exempt from state and municipal and federal taxes in the United States. I don't think there are many bondholders, you know, in this room, but, you know, bondholders were very attracted to these bonds of the Puerto Rico government because they were, as I said, triply exempt from taxes. Now, needless to say, you have an economy which is not growing, government revenue which is not growing either, and a growing debt. It's a formula for a debt crisis at some point in the future, and this is evidently what we got. by the year 2014, the government of Puerto Rico was paying more in the service of the debt, for example, than in financing the public school system in Puerto Rico. With the money that you spent financing the debt, you could have another parallel school system to the one that you had. And by June of 2015, the governor of Puerto Rico recognized publicly that the debt of Puerto Rico was unpayable, that it was just not going to be able to keep servicing this debt. And again, to make a story short, in June of 2016, Congress, I should give you another detail that as opposed to municipalities in the United States, Puerto Rico corporations cannot recur to Chapter 9, you know, the bankruptcy chapter in the US bankruptcy code. So in 2016, June of 2016, Congress approved the legislation known as PROMESA, which the actual name is Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Stability Act. You know, Congress being the cynics that they are, they call it PROMESA. You know, the acronym for that is PROMESA, which means promise in Spanish. And this PROMESA measure creates an oversight board, better known in Puerto Rico as a control board. It's an appointed board by the President of the United States, appointed by the President, was appointed by President Obama, has 7 members. This measure and the board provide absolutely no money for economic reconstruction in Puerto Rico, not one dime for economic reconstruction. It creates this board, and this board promotes, needless to say, this is a very undemocratic structure. It's named by the president, it's not elected by anybody. And what it promotes, as you will see in a minute, are very severe austerity measures, which have a very unjust impact on Puerto Rico. So this law is colonial, it's undemocratic, it's economically unjust and regressive, and this is what we are living under right now. This board is empowered to look over Puerto Rico's finances. The government of Puerto Rico has to it was mandated to elaborate a fiscal plan, a multi-year fiscal plan, and then it has to fit its annual budgets to that multi-annual fiscal plan, all under the oversight of this board. The board can, as it has done, reject plans formulated by the government of Puerto Rico and require that they rewrite them to their preferences and so on. So in March 2017, last year, before the storm, the government of Puerto Rico formulated and the board certified a 10-year plan for Puerto Rico. After the storm, this plan had to be reformulated, evidently. So now we have a 5-year plan that was certified in March of this year, March 2018. Now, all the plans and all the actions of the board basically follow the traditional, by now traditional neoliberal script that you all know. The debt crisis is attributed to big government. The problem, supposed problem, is government is too big. So therefore the solution to the debt crisis is to shrink the government and shrink public employment and public expenditures. And the economic crisis is attributed to the fact that workers have too many rights and there are too many regulations on business. So the solution to the economic crisis, according to them, is to eliminate working class rights and working class benefits and to eliminate regulations on business in Puerto Rico. So the formula for bringing Puerto Rico out of the debt and the economic crisis, according to the board, is to reduce workers' rights, to reduce public expenditures, and to reduce regulations on business. To give you an idea, the present plan contemplates reductions in pensions of public employees in Puerto Rico, which are already inadequate and very low. So in some cases, they want to reduce them 10%, 20%, depending on the pension. reduction in public education expenditures, which again are already inadequate, so they want to reduce them even more. This includes actually closing many schools, more than 300 schools in Puerto Rico they're trying to close. Many schools which are the center of the lives of many communities. These are not simply educational institutions, but much of the life of many neighborhoods in Puerto Rico revolve around the school. And so eliminate the school and you basically kill much of the community life that exists in these communities. The same thing with the University of Puerto Rico. The government wants to halve, to cut by half, the government support of the government of Puerto Rico. Of course, it has other funds that it gets from somewhere else, but what government gives to Puerto Rico, they want to cut by half. That includes closing. That's what I have.
It's not where you've spoken.
Okay, thank you. The government of Puerto Rico, they want to close or almost close some campuses of the University of Puerto Rico. Again, this not only has an impact on university education, there are many municipalities in Puerto Rico that have campuses of the University of Puerto Rico in which, for example, Utuado is in the center of the island, has a campus of the university, and the budget of the campus of the University of Puerto Rico in Utuado is bigger than the budget of the municipality of Utuado. So by far the most important economic activity in all these region is the University of Puerto Rico. You close the University of Puerto Rico there, you basically close the economic activity in the whole area. It's not only, you know, a question of educational aspect of the thing, which is important enough. It also has this impact on the surrounding communities. They want to increase the cost of many government services. Again, a prominent one is the tuition at the University of Puerto Rico. They already decreed a doubling of the tuition. It's not a 10% hike or 20% hike. They're doubling the tuition in Puerto Rico. That's going to evidently make it more difficult for many people to study, particularly low-income people. They want to privatize important government agencies. The most prominent ones are the electric system, which is government owned. They want to privatize that. And they also want to privatize or semi-privatize the school system through the model of the charter schools that you know well in the United States. In fact, it's copied from the United States. They are also going after, as I said, the private sector workers. They're trying to eliminate. In Puerto Rico, there are many legally mandated benefits that workers have, sick leave, paid vacations, an end of the year bonus, and so on. They want to eliminate all of these or reduce them very significantly. And they want to eliminate, this is a major bone of contention, they want to eliminate in Puerto Rico. We have this notion of arbitrary firing. That is to say, there are reasons that the law recognizes for which your boss can fire you, and there are arbitrary firings, which are firings that that cannot be justified on any of these things. And arbitrary firings means that it doesn't mean that they can fire you, but it means that the employer has to pay a compensation for doing that, and that limits a little bit, you know, the power of the bosses to fire people. So evidently they want to simply eliminate that. They want to establish what in the U.S. I guess you call employment at will, is the concept, which we don't have in Puerto Rico yet. And not to leave anybody out, they also want to impose some sort of workfare or limitations on welfare benefits on people who receive these welfare benefits. So they are going after public employees, private employees, people who receive government services, and welfare recipients. Now, needless to say, all of these promises or promesa are false promises. I won't go much into that because I have that much time. There's very little reason to think that lowering the benefits of Puerto Rico's workers is going to promote economic growth in any way. The only sure thing that is going to happen is that workers are going to be impoverished, they're going to be more exploited, and the bosses are going to get richer. And there's no Even the plan approved by the government, you know, the official statistics that they give, they don't foresee any growth of Puerto Rico's economy before 2024. So even they, the people who are imposing these things, are not saying, you know, the economy is going to grow as a result of this. Maybe in, you know, 8 years or in a decade, the economy of Puerto Rico will start growing again and generating more employment if we do these things now. Now, evidently they do these things because there are some people who do stand to benefit from this disaster. There are employers who want to exploit Puerto Rico's worker more, and they stand to benefit from all of this. There are the creditors who want to squeeze at least some debt payments out of Puerto Rico as a result of this. There are the privatizers who want to profit from privatizing the schools and privatizing the electric system and so on. And there are the corporations who want to keep having a tax holiday in Puerto Rico. So they are very much behind this this policy. So a final detail about the crisis, and then to go into our response in the last 5 minutes. Even all of these terrible measures that I mentioned were not enough for the creditors. So they were not willing to come to an agreement with the government of Puerto Rico in order to restructure Puerto Rico's debt on the terms that the Puerto Rico government offered. So at that point, the board took advantage of one aspect of the PROMESA Act, which is that they could file in the federal court for something similar to a bankruptcy procedure. That is, they go to the federal court and they say the government of Puerto Rico cannot pay its debt, and the whole renegotiation of the debt is now under the supervision of a federal judge in the south of New York district, Judge Laura Taylor Swain. So the whole negotiation with the creditors now goes on under the supervision of the federal court in New York. Now, our response to all of this, how much time do I have left? 5 minutes, okay, perfect. Our response to all of this. Well, if I were to summarize what we need in Puerto Rico is, first of all, we need a well-funded economic program of reconstruction economic program, including the possibility of making the very rapid transition to renewable energy, which is a problem in itself in Puerto Rico. And we need, secondly, a process of decolonization and self-determination in Puerto Rico in order to resolve the colonial problem. And perhaps particularly important since we are here, we need all the allies we can get in the struggle for both things, because none of these things can be attained by us alone. The problems of Puerto Rico are the result, as I will reemphasize at the end again, as the result of an economy which is completely subordinated to the interests of private interests, private corporations, to the rule of the market, to the rule of capitalist competition. So solving the problems of Puerto Rico requires an expansion of the public sector, not a reduction of the public sector. It requires an expansion of the role of economic planning as opposed to market competition. It requires exactly the opposite of what has been imposed on us for many years. Now, as a minimum immediate program, we have put out a program which is in your document. There's a little list in there at some page, which includes many elements. One of them is to revoke PROMESA, this legislation that I mentioned before. Another one is to maintain the stay on suits that the creditors can put on Puerto Rico's government for not paying the debt. Another one is, I'm going to go into that a little bit longer further down, to annul, to audit and annul the part of the debt which is illegitimate, to adopt, as I said, an economic reconstruction plan, to stop austerity measures and privatization, and to revoke the labor law reforms that I mentioned before, and to seek a sizable funding from the Congress of the United States for the economic reconstruction of Puerto Rico. Now, before Maria, we had asked for auditing the debt and renegotiating what was left, if anything was left, with certain priorities in mind, pensions and economic development and public services. After Maria, we changed that. Our position now is that we should cancel the debt. There's just no way that we can pay 1 cent of this debt after the impact of Maria, which I won't describe to you. I can go into afterward because I don't have time. This is no longer a demand that only radicals make, but in mainstream economies such as Stiglitz and other people have said, yes, after Maria, we have to cancel the debt. You know, there's just no other thing to do now but that. Another interesting thing after Maria is that for some years now, my party and other radical groups have said that Congress, as I said, should give money to Puerto Rico, should finance some of the reconstruction of Puerto Rico. And we even spoke, you know, of $5 billion a year that Congress at least should give to Puerto Rico to reconstruct the island. And many mainstream economists said, you know, this is crazy, this is demented, this is never going to happen. Well, it so happens that after Maria, there's supposedly about $9 billion that Puerto Rico is going to get every year for 6 years as a result of the impact of Maria. So the money was there. You know, they are giving more money than we were asking, you know. So the money was there. The only reason why it wasn't made possible, you know, it was the only reason why the money was not granted is because evidently Congress, you know, represents not the Puerto Rican people or the American working people, it represents the people who exploit all of us, and they are not going to do any of that. And that's my final point, which is that I think that everything that I have said about Puerto Rico, I think should not come as a complete surprise to the American people, American workers, and surely to the people in this room. Because, you know, government cutbacks of public services, attacks on working people's rights, the use of unelected boards in the context of budget crisis to impose all of these measures and so on, tax cuts on the rich and the use of the resulting deficits to cut public services, none of this is unique to Puerto Rico. This has, you know, this has been what you have lived through in the past decades. You know, and I have a quote in there in the presentation of someone describing the actions of the of similar board in the New York fiscal crisis in the 1970s, and you just have to substitute Puerto Rico for New York and a few other names, and you get a precise description of what's happening in Puerto Rico now. So what I'm saying is therefore that We have to see the struggle in Puerto Rico as part of the same struggle that you have in the United States. Many times when we speak about Puerto Rico, we emphasize the uniqueness of Puerto Rico's situation and the need for solidarity with Puerto Rico. I also like to emphasize the not only the uniqueness of the Puerto Rican situation, but the similarities. You know, it's very similar. It's more acute, it's more accentuated, it's more, perhaps, you know, a degree more terrible, but it's still the same situation that you have in the United States, and therefore the same struggle that we need to lead in Puerto Rico. There are many examples in the past of how struggles in the U.S. and struggles in Puerto Rico were able to work together. I won't give any details because I don't have time. You know, in the 1930s, the struggles of the CIO and of the labor movement in Puerto Rico, which was also going through a period of renewal at the time. Not long ago, the struggle against the Navy in Vieques, in which we had the struggle in Puerto Rico and a very strong movement in the U.S. against the presence of the Navy in Vieques. There's an interesting example in the epoch of the New Deal, which I don't think we should mechanically copy for the present or any way or anything like that. But there was even a federally funded program of economic reconstruction in the 1930s in Puerto Rico, which again we don't have to copy, but there was a program federally funded to distribute land, to operate public utilities as public utilities, to construct necessary infrastructure and so on and so forth. So it's not impossible, it has been done before. To conclude, before Connor puts me out of this podium, all of these things that I have been proposing only begin to solve the problem. As I said at some point in the presentation before, Puerto Rico has been, ever since 1900, 120 years now, basically, has had free access to the US market, free movement of capital between Puerto Rico and the United States, free movement of commodities between Puerto Rico and the United States, free movement of money between Puerto Rico and the United States, free movement of people between Puerto Rico and the United States. These, according to the apologists of capitalism, are the ideal conditions, the textbook conditions for Puerto Rico to grow and to become level with the United States, to achieve its economic development, more or less the same economic standards. 120 years after this pure experiment on neoliberal market capitalist economy, Puerto Rico is still an underdeveloped country, you know, under the conditions that I mentioned before. So we have to conclude the problem is capitalism. There are many economists in Puerto Rico and the US who keep, you know, trying to find which are the obstacles that prevent Puerto Rico from growing, you know, and the obstacle is capitalism. You know, they don't see it, you know, because they are not able to question the system. So I think that as we build a movement for adequate hurricane relief and we build a movement to deal with the present crisis in an immediate way, we also have to build a movement against capitalism that does not only want to limit capitalism, but wants to abolish capitalism. And I know that's not going to happen tomorrow, but whatever we do now regarding debt or regarding economic reconstruction or whatever, we also have to do it in the perspective of building a movement against capitalism. And needless to say, I think that's an international struggle, and the better we coordinate in that struggle, the better for all of us. So, thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.